Howdy, regulars. This is Regular Dispatch 113. It's October 7th, 2020. Once I left the Dillo, I never went back inside, except once, to see my fellow native Mississippian, Mose Allison, the jazz singer and pianist who'd managed to carve out a regular touring stop at the Armadillo. My aim was to give Hank Ulrich free rein to do whatever he felt he needed to do, without me hanging around or dropping by to ask how things were going. Even if Hank had wanted my advice, I knew that Randy McCall and Bruce Willenzik, who were helping him run the show now, didn't want me looking over their shoulders. Or was I just being self-righteous and bitter? That probably figured into my avoiding the old joint, too. In my last months at the Dillo, to escape the pressure and depression, I'd begun spending a good deal of time hiding. My first option, the number one bar behind the Nighthawk, Austin's most storied coffee shop restaurant, had become too popular. My next place was the back room at Matt's El Rancho on East 1st Street, now East Cesar Chavez Street. During my rambles down 6th Street, I'd noticed a little place on Sabine Street. It was a half block off East 6th and a half block from police headquarters. The rent was $125 a month. The place had my name on it. In fact, the day I resigned at the Armadillo, I knew exactly where I was going next, what kind of dive it was going to be, what the name would be, and everything. It was going to be the greasiest spoon in town. All this happened the day after I turned in my badge at the Armadillo. The name of the new joint was the Raw Deal. The modest to the point of crude concept was that it would be a beer joint that also sold some stuff to eat. Even with the bare bones aesthetic in mind, getting the property ready to open presented enough of a challenge that I didn't think about the Armadillo very much. A lot of it was hard labor that I did myself. I scraped the linoleum off the floor, tore down the wall between the kitchen and the dining area, moved in the big refrigerator that my mother, Beulah, had left me to take to the Dillo, and smeared a little paint around. The 30th day of my work fell on December 7th, 1976, Pearl Harbor Day, and I threw myself a little surprise party. Much to Beulah's dismay, I did not paint over the mural that covered the dining room wall. One half of the wall depicted Mexican revolutionaries storming out of a landscape that continued across the other half of the room, while in the foreground, white women whose naked chests were pierced with arrows were being scalped by Indians. Looking out on the street, from one of the forefront windows, was the face of Adlai Stevenson II, the late Democratic politician, in a gigantic blow-up of the cover of Life magazine from 1952. Even though he was bald and bland-looking in a rumpled gray suit, the magazine's red logo on the top and the red banner on the bottom made the image reminiscent of the communist Chinese propaganda posters of Chairman Mao. I have no recollection of where I found the poster, but I thought it sent an appropriate message to potential customers, a message that was also expressed on a big sign by the cash register. Remember, you found the raw deal. The raw deal didn't go looking for you. I filled up a jukebox with instrumental records. It was Woody Roberts' idea and a great one. If one of the records had a vocal on the other side, on the selection label for that track, I wrote, "Scratched, do not play." On the rare occasions that one of those songs got played, I'd reach behind the box and hit the reject button. If I could easily ID the culprit, I'd growl something like, "Damn it, can't you read?" The Raw Deal opened on Christmas Day, less than 2 months after I left the Armadillo in Hank's hands. New Year's Day 1977 was the city's official swearing-in day. Ann Richards came down to the joint to be sworn in as Travis County Commissioner. Frank Ivey was sworn in as Justice of the Peace for Precinct 1, and I was sworn in as President of the Musicians Union, Local Number 433. Heading up the union was my way of avoiding complete presidential withdrawal after leaving the Armadillo. Charlotte McDaniel, longtime secretary of the union, had nominated me. 6 months later, I resigned, forever cured of political aspirations. Michael Priest was the first person from the Armadillo to pop in and visit. He also did a few artistic things for me. He made the sign by the cash register, "Remember the Raw Deal didn't come looking for you," and repainted the sign outside so it read, "The Raw Deal Number 1. I fed Michael pork chops and hash browns. The menu was very, very simple. There would be no live music. The dining room could accommodate 32 people. The bar separated the dining room from the kitchen. A heater AC unit from a mobile home was set up next to the jukebox in front of a little window blocking a view of Waller Creek, the downtown stream that was in those days permanently trashed. The only place in the raw deal where I could hide was up against the double-door refrigerator in the middle of the kitchen. I'd stand with my shoulder blades against it, suck on a joint, and blow toward the window next to the stove. The stove's grease-encased exhaust fan took my exhaled toke toward the police station just down the creek. East 6th Street was seedy and run down in the late 70s. The Two Nickel Cab Company and the Stallion Adult Bookstore, right around the corner, provided a lot of human interest stories for entertainment, along with contributing to the generally bad reputation of the neighborhood. The Two Nickel had a shine stand out front and a pay telephone. The phone was used primarily by people calling their local bookie. More often than not, there were two or three unmarked delivery cars at the curb. There was a Humpty Dumpty grocery store on 6th, and the drivers took a lot of delivery orders from customers who didn't have a car. The drivers also did a brisk business selling little brown bags of Mexican heroin to local junkies. The Raw Deal's one-room layout was a lot easier to manage than an armory complex. When I was asked why this specific place suited me, I said it was the smallest place I could find. I could run it by myself. Galen Barber, my favorite sanitation engineer at the Armadillo, joined me as cook, waiter, and cashier, the same jobs I performed. He had a shift, and I had a shift. I was very familiar with a few other joints in town where the owner, not the customer, was always right, and I wanted the Raw Deal to be that way too. One of the classic gruff eateries in town was Virginia's Cafe on South 1st Street. Virginia had the best plate lunch operation in town. The Dry Creek Inn near Mount Bonnell was another. The bartender proprietor there was the notoriously surly Sarah Ransom. The Hambly brothers ran the Hofbräu, a stripped-down steakhouse on West 6th Street, where steaks were pan-fried and cheap. Bag of Chicken on South Lamar Boulevard was run by Chicken Dick Jennings, a guy whose nickname gave him license to be cranky. The rough, almost grouchy comportment of the people who ran these places was part of the atmosphere and attraction. There was something to it. Each place had something special to offer, and in place of being treated like royalty, you got theater. At Virginia's, you had to follow strict rules or risk getting chewed out. At her cafe, the procedure was to choose from her handwritten menu, write your order of one entree and three vegetables on a small pad using a stubby pencil, after which you placed the pad on the corner of the table and sat quietly until she found time to pick up your order and walk it back to the counter. I remember the first time Mike Tollison came to a business lunch there and made the mistake of arriving late. Virginia briefed him on procedure and assigned him a table next to the rest of the party. Several minutes later, he noticed that he was being ignored. After she'd swept past his table several times, Mike made the near-fatal error of attempting to hand his order to her. She stopped on a dime, snatched it from his fingers, and slammed it down so hard that his water glass nearly fell over. "Mister," she said through clenched teeth, "all these people are before you, and I don't think you've got time to wait." Chicken Dick was famous for only serving his deep-fried, stuffed jalapenos to his favorite customers. Sarah Ransom was known to scream at people at the top of their lungs if they ordered a beer brand that wasn't written in pencil or crayon on the refrigerator. Customers who left tips on the bar got chastised for ignoring the porcelain piggy bank on the bar. "Money goes in the goddamn pig," she'd say. If you'd gotten thrown out of her place 25 years ago, she'd spot you in a minute and toss your ass out the door again. Once I was at the Hofbräu with my friend Monty Quick, a regular patron of the steakhouse, when he was served a bad steak. He felt bad about presenting a plate of chewed gristle to old Tommy Hamby, who owned the joint, but he did. "Mr. Hamby," Monty said, "I've been eating here for 25 years, and this is the first time I've had a steak like this." Hamby took the plate and scraped it into the trash. He said it'll be better next time. From the Hofbräu, I went straight to the Raw Deal, a new motto in hand. Fletcher Boone, a painter and sculptor who had smoothly transitioned from customer to owner, liked the sound of it so much, he immediately began working on a scrape of cardboard with a felt marker. Two beers later, he was done, and a sign appeared above the door reading, "It'll be Betty next time." It stayed up a couple of weeks. I thought it was a tribute to one of our regulars who worked down the street at Texas Monthly Magazine. Her name was Betty Moore, and she could have had me without much effort at all. My first regular at the Raw Deal was James Bailey, the straightest-looking customer ever, who stepped through the screen door and ordered the first of many bottles of Pabst Blue Ribbon beer. Bailey always wore a blue pinstripe suit. His necktie had a perfect Windsor knot, He wore shiny cufflinks and wingtip shoes. Most impressive of all was the badge he carried reading, Texas State Board of Pharmacy, Agent 01. Bailey was gregarious, theatrical, and almost impractically smart. A graduate of the first class at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at UT, he had taught Russian for the CIA. He had a frontal lobe like a supercomputer. He was also, I learned, a lonely person. As unlikely as it might seem, James Bailey and I became friends, and he adopted the raw deal as his living room. He could talk for hours on end without stopping, and only rarely did I ever see him sit down. One day when the raw deal was closed, which could have been a Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday, Bailey came banging on the door. I unlocked it, and he came inside with something hidden inside his jacket that turned out to be a large brown pharmacy bottle. The bottle was a vintage beauty with 2.5-inch cork stopper instead of a lid. The label had a skull and crossbones, and underneath, antique lettering that said, cocaine. The bottle, he explained, had been mailed to the Board of Pharmacy from a college somewhere in the state where it had been discovered by someone cleaning out an old safe. No doubt the college officials just wanted to do the right thing. Bailey and I certainly appreciated it. He was in a hurry. Get me a box of Sweeta, he said. I understood his urgency. Wasting no time, I grabbed a box of the artificial sweetener, and he began tearing open packets 2 and 3 at a time. Empty that thing into something clean, he said, meaning the antique bottle. I've got to get back to the office and lord over the ritual flushing of the Sweeta down the toilet. He came over to my house that night. Using a triple beam scale I had borrowed from Oat Willie's, we weighed the contents. We were a little surprised that it weighed out to be less than we had anticipated, but the coke was so fluffy, you worried that it might fly away when you weren't looking. Among my regular customers, Ann Richards was one of my favorite people to talk to. She and another well-known and powerful Texas politician, Bob Bullock, were very close to each other before they became non-friends. Bullock was state comptroller when I had the raw deal and was later elected lieutenant governor and served 2 terms. With the knowledge that on occasion I had special t-shirts printed, one day Ann came to me and asked if I might have some made to honor her friend Bob. Bullock was in the middle of a campaign and Ann wanted a t-shirt that would pay tribute to his notorious raging temper and mean-spiritedness. What about something that incorporated an image of the Ugandan dictator Idi Amin? The more we talked about it, the more perfect it sounded. I called Michael Priest, and I asked him to create a drawing of Idi Amin wearing his military cap, standing tall behind an old-fashioned cash register, ringing up sales tax. I specified the words, Idi Amin for comptroller, should appear in large lettering. I sold dozens of the shirts to Bullock's friends and enemies both, even to members of his staff. Once he found out about the shirts, sales immediately stopped. On election day, Bullock sailed to victory, and that was no surprise. In 1973, when Bullock was still the Texas Secretary of State, he'd been a regular at the Beer Garden. He was politically ambitious, and it was known that he was thinking about running for either state comptroller or treasurer. Bullock's daily companion was Ed Wendler, a significant political operator on a more local scale. Wendler was a lawyer who represented developers, a Yellow Dog Democrat street activist who favored pressed blue jeans. Feeling ballsy one afternoon, I stopped by their table to ask Bob if he'd made up his mind which office he planned to seek. Yep, just now, and you'll be the first to know, he said. I've learned that my liberal friends don't trust me enough to want me as treasurer. I've also learned that they don't know what comptroller means, so I'm going to take that one and shove it up their asses. Later that day, as Ed and Bob were visibly approaching their limit, Bullock waved me over again. He wanted to know if I saw Willie Nelson regularly. At the time I did, and I told him so. Bullock wanted me to ask Willie to play a fundraiser for his campaign. Then he went on to remind me that he had grown up in Hillsboro, Texas, the town next door to Abbott, where Willie had grown up. Willie would come into Hillsboro on the interurban bus, and when he got off the bus, toting his guitar, Bullock and his buddies would give Willie a hard time. They'd make Willie take his guitar out of his case and sing a few songs under the implied threat that if he refused, they'd beat him up. Bullock seemed to think it was hilarious. Apparently, no one had told him that Willie was generally pleased to sing and play guitar for anyone, anywhere, at the drop of a hat. I said I'd be glad to pass along the request. I said I saw Willie a few days later and relayed Bullock's request. Willie wanted to know what I thought of Bullock's politics. I told him that Bullock had a future in whatever political arena he chose. Then Willie asked if there was anything else I thought he should know. The only thing I had to add was what Bullock had told me about when they were growing up, which I told him. Willie listened thoughtfully, scratched his chin, cocked his head, and said, "Would you mind telling Mr. Bullock, from me, to go fuck himself?" "No, I don't mind at all," I said. All right, I'll stop there. That's a little more from our good friend Eddie Wilson from his book, Armadillo World Headquarters, which he wrote with Jesse Sublett. It's basically his memoir, and it is fantastic. He's a hell of a storyteller. One of the most gifted people with turn of phrase I've ever met, or even just seen, just seen it all, counting like television or radio or anything. Eddie's just amazing. It's a little peek into his world. He left the Armadillo midway through its decade, handed the keys to Hank Ulrich to run it, and I think I read a Brad Buchholz profile of Hank Ulrich in here before. You can find it, I'm sure, somewhere in one of these episodes. If this one will be at, I guess, regular.fm/113, and there'll be a tag that says Austin, probably. And maybe there's a tag for Hank Ulrich. You can speed look around if so inclined. And it's amazing, too, to think about, like Ann Richards, that was her first political win, I believe. Travis County Commissioner, being sworn in at this little tiny one-room dive bar on 6th, it's on Sabine, in between 6th and 7th. It's this little tiny street that's in between I-35 and Red River. And last I was there, it was like a sandwich shop. But I've seen a bunch of pictures, and Eddie has pictures of just all these Texas writers. It really became a haunt for Austin's most gifted writers. And so a hell of a story. And of course, we get a little, another glimpse of a tiny little vignette about Willie Nelson. There'll never be another. There'll just never be another like him. You know, it's the morning after learning that Eddie Van Halen passed away yesterday. And I definitely remember when sort of first little radio in my room as a young kid, 9, 10 years old, something like that, and playing Q102 and KZEW, Dallas radio stations, rock radio stations, that, and so that must have been around the time of, you know, Van Halen 1 and 2, really. And I remember those songs. I remember when MTV came out, or at least when we added it to our house in 82, I think it was. It could have been late 81. And Van Halen didn't have the music videos that would come later, like the produced things like from the 1984 album. But they had a like live performance. Like I vividly remember Unchained and stuff like that. And yeah, they were awesome. And last night I was watching some old interviews of the band, and especially Eddie, and just, you know, really incredible stuff, incredible talent. So it's a bummer. 65 is young. Willie is in his 80s. Eddie Wilson is approaching 80. Like all these people that have given so much. Also, too, I suppose it makes me grateful for all the live music I have seen. Seen just an absolute ton of it. Really saw just a ridiculous amount of concerts when I was in high school. It's hilarious to look back at the ticket stubs, by the way, because they're all list price of $18 to $22, say. And these were like incredible floor seats and stuff. We went out of our way to get great seats. And it was very affordable and accessible to go back then. They hadn't learned yet to just use pricing to get what the scalpers were getting on the first transaction. It's a lot pricier these days. So we were, you know, mowing yards and working at Ranger Stadium, pointing cars in the parking lot. Was able to go to a whole bunch of shows. I always had about 5 or 6 stubs waiting for the show. Would go to one and get 2 more tickets basically to the next, some other shows. When I finally do start writing and getting stuff out, WordPress or otherwise, like I've got a whole bunch of those stubs, and I need to just take nice scans or photos and tell some stories. It was amazing. And then, of course, living in Austin, I'm sure it's not the best music town. If what you want to do is have a career in music, there are other places to go where there are bigger companies, jobs, salaries, that kind of thing. New York, LA, Nashville. However, it's like probably could literally be the best town in the world for enjoying live music, for experiencing it. It's an embarrassment of riches still. COVID and the lockdowns have really blasted that to oblivion. But places like the Saxon Pub and the Continental Club and the Cactus Cafe and all of these, I mean, to be able to get a double bill of John D. Graham and James McMurtry or Ephraim Owens and James McMurtry or whatever, it's just truly amazing. And then, of course, touring shows and all of that. It's really quite something. So, you know, reading Eddie's tales and Ray Benson's version of events and Jonick Petoskey biographies and all of that is a way to really soak it up and appreciate the history and go back through sort of all the different eras and understand the lineage of things and appreciate to whom we owe such a great debt. And it's our spot now to kind of leap into this and carry it forward so we don't lose it. We don't lose this signal that's quintessentially Austin and part of this place. It's also really cool to hear him tell the stories when he's talking about the raw deal and having some beer and a simple menu and very scaled down, stripped down thing to talk about Virginia's Cafe. I'd never heard of that place. I've been to Dry Creek many times. And when Sarah was still around, he didn't mention the cloakroom here because I guess it doesn't serve food. I guess he could have mentioned the cloakroom. I don't know why he didn't mention the cloakroom. But as I understand it, maybe it wasn't around then. I don't know. But it's a classic little dive bar just west of the Capitol. You could basically throw a baseball standing on the Capitol grounds and hit the front door. But your baseball would have to bound down some stairs. You enter at like the basement level, and it's a tiny little dive bar. Popular with the Texas State Ledge when they are in session, as they say. One of the beautiful things here in the state is the legislature works about 6 months every 2 years. It's fantastic. And then they literally go home. And so when the ledge is in session and all the lobbyists rein in following them, it's noticed. It's noticed. It's felt. It's in the press. And you can go down to the cloakroom and kind of soak it in. So hearing about some of those places and some of the characters, wonderful, fascinating stuff. What else would I say? I guess it is pretty early in the morning. It's right almost at 7 o'clock. I did run 3 miles earlier. I ran 6.5 yesterday, but in the late afternoon, evening. And no, I guess yesterday, that was an evening run 2 days ago. Yesterday was maybe 8 in the morning before I really started the work day or started it up again. I'd been up early, but I'm trying to make myself lace them up and get outside on a run while it's dark and just knock that out. I'm going to make a go for the Austin Marathon, which is scheduled for Valentine's Day. We'll see if they're able to have crowds and even just the runners downtown and all of that when the time comes. We're going to start the training, and your 18-week kind of training window kicks off on Monday, October 12th. So ideally, I'm hoping to be able to knock out most of those in the dark. Early. Just a good feeling. Good way to start the day, to already have knocked those out. We'll see how it goes. But that's going to be kind of, I'm looking forward to it. It's more running than I've done in a while. So we'll see. I got to take it easy. I'm not going to try to set a personal best time or anything like that. But I would love to have the experience, especially with this go-around. My daughter in the mix. Jen has been with Jen when I finished one of these, but not with our girl. So that's something to look forward to. Y'all have a really good one, and I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks.